www.ncbc.org or join us on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. On December 25th, 1991, as tearful aides looked on, Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev resigned. The Soviet Union officially ceased to exist. In a new book, journalist and writer Connor O'Cleary details that momentous day and the critical events leading up to it. His new book is titled Moscow, December 25th, 1991. Connor O'Cleary is here in the studio with me. He has written many books, in fact, three since I last saw him 6 years ago. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. So good to see you again.
Nice to see you again, Diane.
Thank you. You really had a front row seat to this drama. How so?
Well, in 1986, the Irish Times decided to open its first ever bureau in Moscow, and I was the Irish Times. I was a staffer at the time, and I was sent to open the bureau. And I was there for most of the last 4 years, 4.5 years of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev's perestroika, and all the upheavals that went on coming up right up to the end of the Soviet Union.
And, of course, Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin are the two main players here. Talk about each of them and how they came to power.
Well, when Gorbachev was made First Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in 1985, he was regarded by the old man who put him in power as somebody who would bring the Soviet Union out of the doldrums. It was a failing society, really. And he put a new team around him, and one of the members of this new team was Boris Yeltsin, who was the head of the Sverdlovsk region of the Soviet Union and had a reputation as a stormer, which in old Soviet times meant somebody who really got things done by pushing people very hard. And Gorbachev gave him the job of reviving Moscow, which was very corrupt, and the guy in charge of Moscow was not doing a good job. Yeltsin began to stir things up in Moscow, but he also began, he was a candidate member of the Politburo, which was the small group of people who decided everything around Gorbachev. And he began to complain behind closed doors that Gorbachev wasn't going fast enough. And he complained in a very insulting way as far as Gorbachev was concerned. And in the end, he said, "I can't stay on in the Politburo. I've got to resign because you're not doing these reforms quickly enough." This resulted in a very unpleasant scene between Gorbachev and Yeltsin. Gorbachev had Yeltsin brought to a party meeting, and for 4 hours, party members were instructed to denigrate him and insult him. And he took it so badly, he tried to commit suicide. And he ended up in hospital. Then Gorbachev took him out of his hospital bed for another dressing down to sack him as leader of the Moscow party. And Yeltsin never forgave Gorbachev for that. He was subjected to another 4 hours of abuse. He was drugged by doctors so he could come from the hospital. And that's the thing that one must always remember, is the hatred that Yeltsin developed for Gorbachev. And just to take it one step further, part of Gorbachev's reforms was to allow elections in every one of the 15 republics of the Soviet Union. Yeltsin became very popular with the people who saw that word leaked out that he was opposing the slow pace of reforms. And he won in early 1991, he won election as president of Russia. He had no power as president of Russia, but he was now one of the 15 presidents of the Soviet Union. And he then set out to get rid of Gorbachev and carve Russia out of the Soviet Union.
We never saw that kind of hatred visible on television, did we? They both behaved in a statesmanlike manner, but you're saying it was behind those doors that this kind of hatred came
on forward. On the very last day of the Soviet Union, the 25th of December 1991, there was a handover of power when Gorbachev handed over the nuclear suitcase, which was the very essence of power, because whoever had the nuclear suitcase, which was a communications device, so £3 a Samsonite case weighing £3 that you could communicate with the nuclear command bunker and send instruct them to send off missiles. That was the essence of power. And as long as Gorbachev had that, he was president of the Soviet Union and he was in control of a superpower. Once he handed over to Yeltsin, the superpower ended. And on that day, that is so important because the Chemodanchik, as the little suitcase was called, changed hands. Now, as you say, in front of the cameras, both were acting in a statesmanlike manner. Yeltsin gave one interview that day to CNN, and he expressed a desire that Gorbachev would retire in a graceful manner, and he refused to criticise him. And then Gorbachev resigned on television later that day. But behind the scenes, Yeltsin was extracting petty revenge for the perceived slights that Gorbachev had.
How?
Well, for one thing, 2 days earlier he had agreed on the terms of the handover with Gorbachev at a nine-hour meeting when both of them got quite drunk, actually, and Gorbachev ended up on a bed in the Kremlin crying. But the terms of the agreement were that Gorbachev would leave on the 25th and he would have 3 days to leave the presidential dacha and to leave his own office and handover. But on the day of his resignation, Yeltsin broke that promise. He sent his security people out to the presidential dacha and literally threw Reza Gorbachev out of the dacha.
Wow.
Scattered all their belongings. Did the same with the official apartment that they had in Lenin Hills. Threw out all their belongings, pictures, books. Gorbachev came home to find this terrible mess. And there, of course, there were other petty things went on as well. The suitcase, the nuclear suitcase, was supposed to be handed over in front of the cameras. NBC had cameras in there, the only camera crew that were allowed to witness this, apart from CNN, which recorded the resignation speech. But Yeltsin was infuriated by Gorbachev's resignation speech because Gorbachev never paid any tribute to him for bringing democracy to the Soviet Union. He implicitly criticised him for a coup in breaking up the Soviet Union. And he was so infuriated, he said, I'm not going to go along to collect this Chemodanchik. I'm going to demand that Gorbachev brings it to me. And there was a standoff, and it was pretty ugly.
The book is titled Moscow, December 25th, 1991. The author, journalist Connor O'Cleary. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. You mentioned Raisa Gorbachev. What role did she play in Gorbachev's rise and his fall?
She played a very important role. She was his consigliere in a way. She was his advisor. She was a very highly educated woman with Marxist views. And when she came here to the United States with Gorbachev, she lectured people on the benefits of Marxism, and Nancy Reagan didn't take to her at all. A lot of Russian people didn't take to her either, because she was the first wife of a Soviet leader, who of course were all men, to appear in public with her husband, to travel around the world with him. Many Russians were quite proud to see a normal person, but the mass of Russian people resented the fact that she could appear in fine clothes and would have access to things that they couldn't dream about. And there's it's a very Russian thing to resent what somebody else has got that you have no chance of getting.
So on the one hand, Gorbachev tried to present her as someone representative of a new age, and yet, on the other hand, she is resented.
Gorbachev once gave an interview, I think it was to Diane Sawyer, in which he said, he was asked, do you confide in Reza? And he said, yes, I tell her everything. And she asked, even matters of state, and he said, yes. And this caused quite a lot of outrage in Russia. And that stirred up resentment. I came across an account by the head of Soviet television, who was a sympathizer with Gorbachev, who lectured Gorbachev about not allowing her on television because people, not too much, because people resented the fact that she was wagging the finger and saying, here's what should be done.
And how did he respond to that?
Well, he responded by saying, you know, she's my wife, and I want to be a normal couple, you know, like other world leaders who bring their wives and or their spouses.
Interesting. Connor Hoag Cleary, we're talking about the last days of the Soviet Union. The book is titled Moscow, December 25th. Do join us, 800-433-8850.
Moonshine Dream is just ahead here on WAMU 88.5. Good afternoon, I'm Elliot Francis. Tonight at 6, WAMU 88.5 presents the Moth Radio Hour, true stories told live on stage. This week, double amputee Amy Mullins chronicles her experiences with prosthetic legs as an athlete, actress, and artist. Former New York City Mayor Ed Koch describes an encounter with his anti-Semitic platoon leader. And then three teens from New Orleans share stories about prejudice and power. It's the Moth Radio Hour tonight at 6 here on WAMU 88.5.
The WAMU member card brings you better value for your dining dollar, and you'll also be supporting your favorite programs. Celebrate our 50th anniversary year with us. Call 800-248-8850 or visit WAMU.org. This program of the Diane Rehm Show was recorded earlier, so we're not able to take new phone calls, but we welcome your comments at drshow.org or join us on Facebook.
Connor Hoag Cleary is with me talking about the last days of the Soviet Union, the events leading up to it. Connor, how did you glean your information?
Well, when I set about to write a book about the fall of the Soviet Union, I realized that the last day was actually full of drama and hadn't been sort of looked at very closely by historians and our journalists. And I began to look for diaries and memoirs that in Moscow, that some published, some not published. And I went to Moscow and talked to people like Igor Gaidar, who was Yeltsin's prime minister at the time and brought in the free market. And I talked to people around Gorbachev, like Andrei Grachev, who was one of his closest aides. And interesting, I found some very human stories that I found intriguing. For example, Gorbachev's closest aide is a man called Chernaev, 70 years old. And I found his diary for that day. He wrote a very full diary of his time with Gorbachev. And his diary for that day, he's reflecting on the fact that freedom is coming to Russia, and that the irony is that he will no longer have freedom to visit his mistress, who's called Luda and lives quite near the Kremlin. And this diary entry details how he would go home at night and leave a bottle of milk and then go off again to be with Luda. And of course, because he's working with Gorbachev, who works all hours, he's free to do this. And he laments in his diary that now he's not going... And he's worried that Luda won't respect him anymore because he won't have a job.
Is he married at the time?
Beg your pardon?
Is he married at
Yes,
time?
Absolutely, yes. And this is the thoughts that are going through his head as he's watching Gorbachev making his resignation speech.
So there were other diaries as well. Who at the top kept a diary?
Chernaev was the most important diary. Gorbachev himself kept a fairly good account. Yeltsin has published his memoirs in Russian and in English. And there have been a couple of very good accounts of the last few days by Palachenko, who was Gorbachev's interpreter. Probably everybody remembers him as the bald man standing behind Gorbachev during the summit meetings. And also Andrei Grachev, his press representative, who kept a very detailed account. And I spent a lot of time with him going over the events of that day.
Connor, there are many in the United States who would argue that it was actually Ronald Reagan who brought the Soviet Union to an end. How do you see the advent of Ronald Reagan and the downfall of the Soviet Union? How connected are they?
Well, he certainly played a role. The Soviet Union was spending 25% of its output on defense. At the time, Western observers thought it was much less, so 25%. And what Ronald Reagan did was he upped the ante with the Star Wars idea. And Gorbachev realized that the Soviet Union just couldn't keep matching the defense capacity of the United States. So that certainly played a role, but I think it was part of a whole dynamic. Gorbachev realized that the Soviet Union was stagnant, the economy was stagnant, and it had to be revived from within. And in the end, it was the impulse of democratic forces inside Russia that brought the Soviet Union to an end. But certainly Ronald Reagan upping the ante was very important.
Talk about those democratic forces inside Russia, plus what was happening in the satellite countries.
Well, Gorbachev made it clear that he would not use tanks to keep the satellite countries in Eastern Europe under the thrall of Moscow. His press spokesman, Gennady Gerasimov, said it's the new Frank Sinatra doctrine, they can do it their way. So it was only a matter of time before those states would break away. And to this day, they're all very grateful to Gorbachev for allowing that. And that brought the Cold War to an end, really. It was the beginning of the end of the Cold War. But the democratic forces in Russia were mostly members of the intelligentsia, you know, in the arts and literature and in the sciences. And they couldn't really get the support of the masses of the people without somebody like Yeltsin. So you had an alliance between the intelligentsia and this very strong-willed, impetuous stormer from Sverdlovsk, who also had very strong democratic impulses. And he was, you know, at the time of the handover, when Gorbachev gave it to Yeltsin, that was the time of greatest freedom in Russian history. The press was free. Yeltsin, two or three years after the Soviet Union collapsed, held completely free elections. His re-election in 1996 was an election like in any other country in the world. So you had a democratic impulse from the intelligentsia and from Yeltsin. And of course, Yeltsin was able to bring the army and the people with him because they respected him as somebody who came from within the communist ranks and wanted to bring change.
As the former correspondent for the Irish Times to Moscow, how much access did you have to those top officials?
At the time, that was really interesting. When I arrived in Moscow in 1986-87, it was impossible to get access to Gorbachev or Ligachev or Ryzhkov or any of the top officials. But as time went on, and especially when Gorbachev held elections to a new People's Congress, there were managed elections, but they were pretty free. At the time of the Congress, members of the Politburo suddenly appeared in the hall, in the hallways outside, available to journalists, and we could go up and talk to Gorbachev and talk to Yakovlev and talk to people that before this had just been figures that we saw on television standing on top of the Lenin Mausoleum once or twice a year.
And do you speak Russian?
I learned Russian there. You couldn't operate as a correspondent in the collapsing Soviet Union without knowing Russian, because a lot of the activity was on the streets, huge demonstrations. We had to travel around and talk to people in different parts of Russia and the Soviet Union to ask what was happening. And they didn't speak English, of course. Why would one expect them to? So, you know, 5 years earlier, you could get away without Russian because you just had an interpreter and he read the newspapers and told you what they were saying.
You also write that despite everything, President Bush and other Western leaders wanted the Soviet Union to stay intact.
That's one of the most intriguing aspects of the whole story of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Bush and Helmut Kohl and other leaders like Thatcher, they really liked Gorbachev. They trusted him. They saw him as a person, as Margaret Thatcher said, we can do business with. But when the Soviet Union was collapsing, there was a lot of concern here in Washington, and Bush reflected this, President Bush reflected this, that you would have 15 independent countries, some with nuclear weapons, which was less preferable to a managed Soviet Union, a reformed Soviet Union, which was the devil we know rather than the devil we don't know. And right up to the end, Gorbachev was trying to reassure President Bush, even 2 weeks before the collapse, that he could still maintain some sort of a role and keep the Soviet Union intact under a new Union treaty where he might continue to control nuclear weapons and foreign policy, but it was too late for that. But there's no doubt that President Bush he went to Ukraine in August of 1991 and lectured the Ukrainians on nationalism, which didn't go down very well with Ukrainians either there or here in the United States. But he was so keen to help his friend, Mikhail Gorbachev, to emerge from this whole mess with the reformed Soviet Union rather than 15 different republics, which would be unpredictable.
And, of course, that was President George H.W. Bush, who was in office at the time. How much before December 25th, 1991, did it become clear that Gorbachev was going to be gone?
Well, interestingly, a lot of people think the end came with the coup, and certainly that was the beginning of the end. The coup happened in August, the failed coup. But from my research in the last dying days of the Soviet Union, the end came with a referendum in Ukraine for independence on December 1st, 1991. And following that, Yeltsin said to Gorbachev, I'm going to go and meet the Ukrainian leader Kravchuk and the Belarus leader Shushkevich, and I'm going to ask them, will they not agree to this new Union treaty we've been talking about? But Gorbachev knew there was treachery afoot. And when those three Slavic leaders met certainly in seclusion, not in secret, but in seclusion in a hunting lodge near the Polish border, they came up with a formula to collapse the Soviet Union. And the formula was very simple. Kravchuk, for one, said, we're going independent. Ukraine's becoming independent. There's I'm not going to agree to any new UN treaty. I don't like Gorbachev. I want rid of him. They come up with an interesting formula, and it was very simple. Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia, and another entity called the Trans-Caucasian Federation, had formally and legally set up the Soviet Union in 1922. They said, OK, the Trans-Caucasian Federation doesn't exist anymore, so we three who set it up can legally collapse it, can legally end it. And they just issued a statement saying that's what we're doing.
Ah.
And following that, Yeltsin or Gorbachev still thought he could persuade them. He called this just an idea. But Yeltsin went to the other republic leaders, including Nazarbayev, who was the head of Uzbekistan, and he was in favour of Gorbachev's new union treaty. But Yeltsin persuaded them, look, it's over. And 3 days before the end, they all met in Alma-Ata, all the leaders of the republics, and they agreed to set up a substitute for the Soviet Union called the Commonwealth, which was a figment. It was just a fig leaf to cover the divorce.
But, you know, it is rather curious that all of this was going on and Gorbachev didn't quite get it. He didn't quite understand what Yeltsin was doing behind his back.
He didn't like Yeltsin at all. He suspected that Yeltsin was conspiring during that last year he was pretty sure that Yeltsin was playing along with the idea of a new union treaty, but at the same time, Yeltsin's people, especially a man called Bourboulis, who was one of his closest aides, were secretly talking to other Republican leaders about how we can get rid of the Soviet Union and get rid of Gorbachev. Gorbachev was firmly of the belief that they wanted to get rid of him rather than the Soviet Union.
In question. What was the primary motive, Gorbachev, or getting rid?
Well, I think the dynamic of history was that the Soviet Union was finished, but part of one of the communist deputies who supported the idea of the Soviet Union continued, he said in the Russian parliament a few days before the end, look, we've got to go through with this just to get Gorbachev out of the Kremlin.
Connor O'Cleary, the book we're talking about is titled Moscow, December 25th, 1991. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've got many callers. We'll open the phones now. 800-433-8850. First to Schwartz Creek, Michigan. Good morning, William.
Good morning, Diane, and thank you very much for such an interesting program.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Can the Commodore validate something that I thought I heard on NPR back around 1991? And it was a translation of a speech made by Gorbachev, where he stood up in front of, and I believe it was called CONCOM, Communist Congress, and he said, I will no longer support the entry of the Red Army into member states of those states who abuse their people. Those leaders who abuse their people can no longer depend on the Red Army to bail them out.
All right. And William, I'm afraid you misheard my pronunciation of Connor O'Cleary's name. He is not Commodore. Can you respond?
Yes, William. That speech took place about 2 years before the 3 years before the end of the Soviet Union. And it signaled to the world that Gorbachev was really serious about reforming international relations. Up to that point, it had always been assumed that if one of the Eastern European countries within the behind the Iron Curtain was to try and seek its freedom, that the Red Army tanks would roll in, as they had done in Prague and as they had done in Hungary. But once Gorbachev made it clear to the leaders of the communist leaders of these satellite states that the army would not be used, then it was only a matter of time before the East Germans and the Czechs and the Hungarians threw off their communist imposed leaders and elected democratic leaders who left the ambit of the Kremlin.
All right. Thanks for your call, William, to Paul in Tampa, Florida. Quick question, Paul.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a very provocative topic. I just wanted to go back to something that the guest had mentioned about the Soviet Union spending, I think he referenced 25% of GDP on the military, and I was hoping he could comment on the effects of U.S. spending on military to kind of outspend them to try to win that battle and what the repercussions were for the United States.
There's absolutely no doubt that the challenge to the Soviet Union coming from the United States in terms of defense spending was played a powerful role in the collapse of the Soviet Union, because Gorbachev realized, and the people in his Politburo realized, that they just couldn't match the technology and the spending of the United States.
And the United States, how was it affected financially? That's the question we'll come back to after a short break. Conor O'Cleary is former Moscow correspondent for the Irish Times.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, Idealism at Work. First, the unpaid internship is a Washington institution, but some say today's internships cross the line from education to exploitation. Plus, lessons from the life of Louis Armstrong, a jazz legend whose offstage legacy is often overlooked. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2, Monday on WAMU 88.5.
And welcome back. Here's an email from Shervon here in Washington, D.C. Ask, please, about the policies of neoliberalism and the role of financial institutions in the transformation of Russia during this time. Another author, Naomi Klein, has written a great deal about this. And Shervon is talking about international financial institutions.
That's a very interesting question. On the very last day of the Soviet Union, Boris Yeltsin's Deputy Prime Minister, Igor Gaidar, was in the old Communist Party headquarters, sitting down with representatives from the IMF to discuss what he was about to do, which was the Big Bang, the transfer from a communist to a neoliberal economic model. And within days of the collapse of the Soviet Union, price liberalization came to Russia with all that that entailed. Remember that up to that point, the Politburo and its ministries set the price for everything, loaf of bread to a barrel of oil. There were teams of international officials in Moscow at the time, and they were preaching to a very receptive group of young reformers around Yeltsin who really wanted to make the transfer from the communist model to the capitalist model very quickly so that it couldn't be rolled back. And that was going on the very last day.
To our last caller, who wondered about the financial strain on the United States that could have come about because of the race to put Moscow out of business, as it were.
Well, I don't think the United States was spending the same amount of its GDP or anything like it on defense because the United States was much more powerful and a much more vibrant economy. The problem with the Soviet Union was that its economy was stagnant, and to try and match what the United States was spending was crippling the Soviet Union.
All right. To Reardon in Detroit, Michigan. Good morning.
Hello there, Diane. Kunastanto, Flanta Connor. My question is, do you feel that Vladimir Putin had a hand behind the scenes in contributing to the fall of the Soviet Union? Because I understand it and have read that he was always seeking the presidency from his days as the KGB. And also, sir, were your movements monitored? Do you felt you were being watched, your correspondence, and as you were out and about gathering the facts up? Thank you.
Well, in regard to the first question, I actually found some interesting things about Putin's role in the fall of the Soviet Union. He was very instrumental in ensuring that the coup failed in Leningrad, as it was then, because he was an aide to the Leningrad mayor, who was a Democrat. And he played a role in helping the coup collapse. At the time of the fall of the Soviet Union, something very interesting happened. The red flag came down all over Russia. Putin was in his office in Leningrad, or at St. Petersburg, as it's now called, and he saw that the Communist Party across the road hadn't lowered the red flag, so he sent workers over to pull it down. The next day it appeared again. He sent workers over again to pull it down. And when this went on for a few days, he eventually sent the workers over with an acetylene torch to cut down the metal flagpole. So he was definitely in favour of the end of the Soviet Union, but he's changed over time. And when he became prime minister, or when he became president of the Soviet Union, he began to bring back some of the symbols of the Soviet Union. He allowed the Soviet army to use the red flag again, though it's not the flag of the country. He changed the words of the national anthem to reflect the victory of Russia in the Great War. He did this to try and bring stability to the country and to satisfy a yearning to go back to the days of the Soviet Union among many people who saw it as a time when you didn't have Chechen or Islamic violence, and a time when people had little, but everybody was more or less treated the same. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. To Englewood, Florida. Hi there, Ken.
Oh, good morning, Diane Connor. Just so interesting what you're talking about, and especially the relationship to Afghanistan and the spending that was going on there, and the U.S. then trying to counter what was going on in Afghanistan, which at the end of the day, we're back there doing the same thing for our own 10 years and related to our own financial challenges.
Well, Ken, that's a very, very crucial element in the fall of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev set about winding down that war, which had been started by one of his predecessors, Brezhnev. This was also draining capital away from the Soviet Union, but it was also a war they were losing. And I remember visiting Afghanistan at that time, and the Russian occupiers brought me to the town of Khost and introduced me to some young women teachers there who weren't wearing the burqa, but who made the point to me very forcibly, if the rebels in the hills, the Mujahideen, who were being supported by the United States, that if they won, they would have to put on the burqa again and would lose the ability to teach their children in schools. And it was really a moment, a very important moment for me in my perception of world politics, because we'd always considered the Russians the baddies and the Americans the goodies, but here it was much more complex.
And here's a question from Diane in Cleveland, Ohio. What role did Pope John Paul II have in the fall of the Soviet Union?
Well, Pope John Paul gave moral support to the Polish people at a time when they were making clear that they would no longer tolerate a situation where they were subservient to Moscow. And because Poland's a very Catholic country and the Pope was from Poland, he became a force that the Kremlin really had to reckon with.
And here's a tweet. Let's see if I can find it. What is your opinion of the connection between the downfall of the Soviet Union and the rising and falling oil prices?
Well, I'm not sure that they're directly related, but certainly rising and falling oil prices have had a huge effect on the fate of Russia. Russia was recovering from the century of communism pretty well during the 1990s when oil prices rose. When oil prices fell, they had a tremendous financial catastrophe, 1996, I think it was. But the benefit of that for Russians was that because the ruble collapsed, they could no longer afford Western consumer goods, and they began to make their own, which was something that they should have been doing all along. So it helped to revive the economy.
And to Nashville, Tennessee. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning. What an absolutely fascinating conversation we're having this morning. First, a comment and a question. My comment is I remember being there and in 1991 and saying to myself, wow, we won the Cold War. We won. And we have a young president coming in, and there's nothing can stop us now. Leadership, there's nothing. We have good leadership, and we had a whole decade of just wonderful leadership in this country. Then flash forward just a decade later, leadership that we had pretty much, in my eyes, lost us the decade after that. And the question I want to ask is, what leadership do they have in Russia? It looks like they have a two-headed monster going on over there. What leadership do they have? Because we see in this nation that if you have the right leadership, you have the 90s, a boom time, and if you have poor leadership, you have the first decade of the 2000s in this country that's really going to cost us here two decades. So how is the leadership in Russia right now, and who's in control? Thank you.
Well, as regards who won the Cold War, at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union on the 25th of December, President H.W. Bush gave instructions that it shouldn't be relayed as a victory in the Cold War. But politics in the United States being what they were, within a month or two, he was claiming victory in the Cold War. And he, in his address to Congress in January of 1992, he said, "We won the Cold War," and he got a huge standing ovation for that. As regards the present leadership in Russia, there's absolutely no doubt that Putin is the stronger of the two. He's prime minister, but there's going to be an election next year for president, and the question is, will Medvedev seek a second term, or will Putin, and he agree that Putin should go back?
So what's going on behind the scenes there?
Well, my opinion is that Medvedev is more of a reformer and a Democrat than Putin, but Putin is very much the stronger person. If you look at Russian TV in the last week or two, it shows Putin, I saw a scene where Putin is riding a motorcycle with the equivalent of Hell's Angels. And now that is putting forward his macho image, and he's always done that before elections, so obviously he's preparing the ground for another run at the presidency.
And do the people prefer Putin to Medvedev?
Well, I can't speak for the Russian people, but there are lots of unhappy people in Russia who try to demonstrate for more democracy and get arrested. There's no right to free demonstration in Russia today. But the mass of the people regard Putin, I think, as someone who has restored dignity. They look back at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union as a time of great national embarrassment. They perceive that they lost the Cold War.
And there's some who even yearn for a Stalin-like regime.
Well, there was a poll done on Russian television recently as to who was the greatest Russian of all times, and Stalin came third. He was promoted by one of the generals who took part in the coup, Varenikov, who was given the job of promoting his favourite for the title, and Stalin came third.
Let's go to Severn, Maryland. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Hi, great conversation, great conversation. I had read a huge work on Russia years ago and was fascinated. What I found fascinating, sir, when you were discussing Yeltsin's disagreement with the administration, I'd just like you to comment. If that was in the Stalin days, you would have never seen Yeltsin again. It was just interesting that he was able to protest, just like we do in America, with political differences, and just get dressed down by, you know, the Russian Senate. But I was just amazed that you had that kind of dissension. And so had freedom really come to such a state where the statesmen could disagree with their...
You're absolutely right, Tony, and that was a key to the development of Yeltsin as a politician. When he was fired as head of the Russian, of the Moscow Communist Party, he assumed that he was finished in politics. In fact, Gorbachev told him, "You're finished in, as a politician." But Gorbachev gave him a job as deputy head of the construction industry, which meant he could stay as a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. But he didn't have a role in the decision-making body. Previously to that, and this is all to the credit of Gorbachev, anybody who disagreed or who was dumped from the top ranks could expect to be either shot in Stalin's time, or sent off as ambassador to Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia, or simply made into a non-person. When Khrushchev was dumped as leader, he was made into a non-person. The newspapers were not allowed to write anything about him, as if he didn't exist. Now, Yeltsin suffered some of that as well. The newspapers weren't allowed to report on him for quite some time, but he was still a member of the of the administration, if you like. And Gorbachev has thought about this a lot in his memoirs. He reflects that he could have got rid of him, but that he didn't, because you know, things had changed in Russia, and those days of assigning people to history were gone.
Interesting. To Greenbelt, Maryland, Jerry, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to comment on the role of President Reagan in the dissolution of the Soviet Union. I think it's greatly exaggerated and politically motivated. I agree with your guest that the spending on defense industries, a guns and butter policy, was a leading factor, as well as perestroika and glasnost. And the Soviet Union had trouble feeding its people in the 70s. I was an intelligence officer in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and it was clear to me that the system wasn't working. And Gorbachev actually was a secretary for agriculture in the late 70s, and I think he realized the impact that defense spending had on the Soviet Union.
Yes, absolutely right. But I think there's more to Reagan's role than just upping the cost of defense for the Soviets. He met Gorbachev at Reykjavik in the first major summit of Gorbachev's time, and they didn't agree on anything there, but they did realize that both of them wished to rid the world of nuclear weapons, that was their ultimate goal. Even though strategically or tactically they were competing on defense. And Reagan came to like Gorbachev and to trust him, and Gorbachev came to have the same opinion of Reagan, that they could work together to make a better world which would have less nuclear weapons. And they began seriously to discuss joint reduction in nuclear weapons. And that was very important in making Gorbachev a figure of substance to the rest of the world.
And finally, email from Ron in Chicago. Number one, is there any chance Russia will make a turn towards democratic reform? And two, I have read that Russians in general prefer economic stability over democratic freedom.
Well, that's the Chinese model. The Chinese leadership about 20 years ago said to its people, okay, you can make money, you can do what you want, you can travel, but don't challenge the system. And we have a form of that in Russia today. But I think the Russian people, as the middle class grows in Russia, they will want more accountability. And there is more of a desire for democracy, I think, among the Russian people today than you would find in China.
Conor O'Cleary, former Moscow correspondent for the Irish Times. Pardon me, his new book is titled December 25th, 1991, Moscow, the last day of the Soviet Union. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Hi there, I'm Sabri Benishore, and welcome to Door to Door, our weekly trip around the region. Today we visit Ellicott City, Maryland, and the Crestwood neighborhood of Northwest D.C.
My name is Ellen Kassoff Gray. I'm a Crestwood resident of 10 years on September 14th. My husband and I own a couple D.C. restaurants and a catering company. We happily exist with wonderful access to Rock Creek Park and to 16th Street, which is obviously a major artery in and out of Washington. We're a tidy little triangle between the park and Mount Pleasant. There's a big age disparity in this neighborhood. My neighbors and I joke, this whole entire side of the street, the lights are on past 11, that whole entire side of the street, they're off by 10. But it's a new old neighborhood because so many people are realizing the houses back here and scooping them up and renovating them. Most of the people hang on to their houses in this neighborhood 40 plus years. You can walk out on your front porch and your neighbor's right there. And I think that gives us a whole different sense of community than single family homes. We're very tight with each other.
My name is Dennis Lane, and I live in Ellicott City, Maryland. We've lived here for about 6 years. Ellicott City sits along the Baltimore County, Howard County border. And it sits actually down in a valley between several hills right along the Patapsco River, actually at the convergence of both the Tiber and Patapsco Rivers. As a matter of fact, that's how the town was established. It was established as a mill. The Ellicott brothers, Andrew, Joseph, and John, I believe, came to the town back in 1760. So geography has always kind of dictated how the town has grown. We have a large professional population, largely driven by people who work at Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Labs, who are over at Fort Meade for the National Security Agency, as well as government in both Baltimore and Washington. Along Main Street, you have galleries, you have coffee shops, you have antique stores, restaurants. It's just, it's like Georgetown in miniature.